There has never been a better time to be yourself. Whoever you are, and whatever you want to be. And nothing symbolises that potential, that shiny possibility, better than a selfie. The kind of portrait that hardly existed just 10 years ago. But the selfie is just the visible tip of a much, much bigger iceberg.
Oh, it's a modern way.
A radical reinvention of who we are, powered by the latest technology. It's changed the amount that we look at ourselves, but I reckon it's also changing what we see. The discrepancy between who we really are and who we say we are online is transforming us.
I have a chip implant.
Yeah.
But don't just take my word for it. I'm off to meet a selection of modern selves who are redefining what it means to be us. Now and in the future. And as you're probably wondering who I am, I'm just going to check. Alexa, who is Ryan Gander?
Ryan Gander OBE is an English conceptual artist who lives and works between London and Suffolk.
So what I want to know is who we are and whether the idea of our actual selves can keep up with the technology that enables it.
Me, My Selfie and I, with Ryan Gander.
Who are you?
I am Ryan.
And who is Ryan?
Ryan is...
He stares upwards for a moment.
You'd have to meet him.
A close-up of a young woman who looks at the camera as if it's a mirror. She seems to be studying her image and seeing imperfections, as if in an advertisement for something.
The impossible dream.
Ryan's looking at his laptop.
The unbeatable fall.
The selfie is a telling symbol of our age. But of course, a selfie doesn't have to be a photograph. Any type of information we choose to share with others online is part of a vast, fractal self-portrait. What we comment, what we hashtag, what we like, who we follow, even our chosen online pseudonym. Whatever we share, we make decisions about, consciously or not, and they communicate messages about us, no matter how trivial or banal.
This is the reason why I don't do Facebook or Twitter. Because I started Instagram for an experiment and became massively addicted to it. And it is hugely addictive. And it's like drug rehabilitation, it feels like sometimes. You know, I go on holiday at New Year with my family and I have a detox and I tried to come off it. And by March, February, Easter time, I'm already back on it.
A group selfie.
And thanks to the culture created by the smartphone, we now live in an infinitely repetitive present tense of self-validation and self-promotion, powered from the palm of our hand. Meet Sophie Lee, a model, dancer, and fire breather. Born in 1996, she has lived with digital technology her entire life. And her favourite app? Instagram. Where Sophie jostled with a billion other users a month for attention, likes, followers, and for the right to be called an influencer in a future where nothing is as important as right now.
When I was a kid, I used to dance around in the living room, be like, I want to be a star when I'm older. And I've always thought in my mind, I want to be known before I die, because I believe you're given one chance.
And since 2010, the best place to get known for many has been Instagram. Sophie posted dozens of times a week, slowly building a following. But then, disaster struck.
On April Fool's Day, I was fire breathing in a venue in Chicago. I left the aircon on, there was some complication. And when I blew the fire basically came back at me. And I was on fire, basically. All I remember was getting rushed to hospital. And then I had to be in hospital. I was in intensive care at first because I couldn't breathe and I couldn't see and I was so swollen. I was in hospital for a month. I've always been positive, but I think this was a big test for me. When this happened, it was just like, wow, that's my face. It makes me money. Even if it didn't make me money, it's the first impression of everyone.
No, I was looking on your Instagram and I was trying to find, like, the moment in the series of pictures, because it's chronological, where it happened.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really find it, because you posted pictures the way you looked before the accident, yeah, after it happened, though.
Yeah, because I hadn't told anyone this had happened. I didn't really share this on Instagram at all, because this was such a personal, life-changing kind of epiphany for me that I didn't feel like I needed to share that yet. So, yeah, I did start posting and carry on posting things that were from the past and before it happened. So, for me, it was... I had to just bite the bullet. And that was only a month ago that I kind of released this story. Yeah, I just released the story because I thought I can't keep hiding anymore because it's not real. And I'm lying to myself, I'm lying to people who kind of look up to me.
And those people were her followers on Instagram, just over 1,000 of them, before the accident.
So what happened when you really, how, when you say release the story, what did you do? You posted a picture on Instagram or?
Yeah, I posted a picture on Instagram with me with no makeup, completely bare, all my scars showing.
What happened? What was the reception to that image? What happened?
So the picture, I didn't expect it, but it went viral. And for me, that was like, wow. I had people from Singapore, Australia, France, Philippines, so many places message me. That for me was like, oh my God, Sophie, you're generally making a change. This is what you've worked so hard for.
Sophie had discovered the power of authenticity in the unlikeliest of places. In the fake world of Instagram, the new truth of her situation shone through.
So you have more followers now. I guess that's the strange irony.
I'd had Instagram for what? How many years? About 3 years? And I only had, like, what? A few thousand followers. But they were just because they just want to see me post nice pictures. Mm. Whereas now people genuinely know what my purpose is. And so when this happened, I think that was when I kind of found who I was. A year ago, I had 1,200 followers. I'm on 19.9K now. And that, for me, is like, wow, so, like, you're doing good. You're doing good, girl. Like, that is a substantial amount of followers to say, this is what you need to carry on doing.
Ryan nods, and she becomes upset.
You're going to make me cry. It's taken a lot of years. It's taken so much to get here.
Ryan's also wiping his eyes, and he hugs her.
And I only ever want...
Thanks for speaking to us about it. It's amazing to hear.
For Sophie, Instagram is a bittersweet contradiction. The outlet that makes visible what some would consider her weakness also is the platform for her strength and for her pride.
Ryan's studio, Suffolk.
Self-portraiture has never been so powerful and full of possibility.
There's a photo from 1839 by Robert Cornelius, which is a photograph he took of himself. And I'd always assumed that this was the first selfie. And it's amazing when you look at the photo because he looks seriously worried, like he's seen into the future. It's as if he's seen a ghost, almost. It's of complete uncertainty and apprehension, as if he's set something into the world that could cause catastrophe. It's almost like he's aware of a potential future that he's unleashed by making this photograph. I found another photograph from 1920, which is a photograph of five gentlemen standing on the roof of a building in New York City. And they're holding a camera themselves with their arms stretched out. And it's one of those cameras that's really heavy because it's in a wooden box. And it actually takes two of them to support it. And I think this is probably the first selfie because it's self-actualized. It's them actually holding it, and you get this image of the shoulder and the arm that you see in the present-day selfie.
A young woman takes a selfie of her and two friends, each of them adjusting their hair before the photo. They're in Trafalgar Square. Now, Ryan's in the National Portrait Gallery. A portrait of Jan van Eyck.
This painting is called Portrait of a Man, Self-Portrait question mark by Jan van Eyck. And it's quite interesting, it says self-portrait question mark because it's not been confirmed whether it is, in fact, a self-portrait. And it was made in 1433, which is a pretty long time ago. And obviously it's a beautiful painting, but I'm not really here to look at its formal qualities like line and tone and shade and things like that. I'm here because I'm really interested in the carving that's actually on the frame. If we look at the bottom, it says, Jan van Eyck made me on the 21st of October, 1433. It's almost like the frame is speaking in the first person. The painting becomes its own individual and talks about the artist. There's this crazy switch of personas. And then at the top, there's more carving that says, Als ich kann. And that translates to, as well as I can. Again, we don't know if when Jan van Eyck painted this painting, he's talking about as well as I can, as in, as well as he can be portrayed by himself, the best version of himself, or whether it's meaning as well as I can in a technical sort of artistic capacity. I mean, the gaze is absolutely piercing, the stare. Of course, now, if you think about self-portraits and selfies, in 700 years, no one will be looking at the pictures that we make of ourselves now because there's just there's a trillion. So how would you differentiate between important or significant and insignificant? We've almost become drowned in self-imagery. This is another Jan van Eyck painting. This one's called the Arnolfini Portrait, and it's from 1434. This is also a self-portrait, but the self-portrait is hidden in it. And if you look right into the centre, there's this concave or convex mirror, and in that it's said that the two figures that are tiny in the mirror are, in fact, one individual and another one that is possibly the artist himself, Jan van Eyck. He's hidden the self-portrait in a commissioned portrait by wealthy people. It's almost like photobombing in the background. And again, even more interesting, is above the mirror, there's a slogan that's written in a sort of Germanic calligraphy, which says, Jan van Eyck was here, not was here, like you'd expect in tagging or sprayed up on a wall, but was here.
Someone photographing a woman in a colourful jacket. Then a young woman moving around as she tries to take a photo of herself.
What I think is completely amazing is how used to seeing people take photographs of themselves alone I've become. I've become almost immune to something that only 5 years ago I would be completely repulsed by. 5 years ago, if I was to witness someone holding a phone out in public space, surrounded by people who were strangers, taking a photograph of themselves and posing for it, I would have found it completely vain and narcissistic and disgusting and embarrassing. And now it's completely normalised and it's part of, you see it countless times every single day. You've become immune to narcissism and vanity.
Welcome to the Freud Museum in North London. First stop, the gift shop.
Freud souvenirs.
I sent a picture of this to my wife and she wrote back saying that it's like me, a future self, which is also, it's exactly the same glasses as well. This wasn't set up before I arrived here and I had never been here before. He's a little thinker, it says on his bottom.
A Freud soft toy in similar clothes to Ryan. A wheelchair user, Ryan makes his way through the museum house.
Smells like damp cats. So this is where Freud would have sat and listened to torrents of self-explanation. I think the strange thing about this sofa and your phone is actually they're really similar types of things because they're both vessels from different times that hold the ability to talk about ourselves. So in the day where Freud would sit here and talk to a patient, those days were quite conservative and people wouldn't talk about their innermost desires and fears and things. And now, of course, with a phone and the use of social media, everybody talks about themselves incessantly, constantly. In the early 1900s, Freud started to write about the ego, and specifically a three-part way of categorising the way that we think about ourselves and define our inner being. So his theory is quite complicated, but it's a bit like, you know, in the cartoons when you get Bugs Bunny and he gets a little devil and he gets a little god on each shoulder. It's a little bit like that. And the ego is the self, and then there's the id, and the id is our impulses and our desires and our need for instant gratification. And then there's the superego, which is the little good guy on the other shoulder. And the superego is our moral and ethical grounding. It's almost like the person that we want to be. When we think about that now in terms of the way that we communicate with technology and specifically social media, you could compare the id, this need for instant gratification, to Twitter. It's the impulse in us all to shout, to be brash, to say ridiculous things that we probably don't believe, to brag, to be narcissistic, to talk about ourselves. And then we could think about other social media platforms like Instagram as the way that we portray an idealized view of ourselves, not who we are, not who we've been, not who people think we are, but who we want to be. I think social media for Freud would have been amazing. We could just go on a patient's Twitter account or Instagram, and I'm sure he could read and diagnose and give suggestions for remedy just by looking at social media. I'll do a selfie with you. Just,
what I'd quite
it's not
like
scripted at all.
Is, obviously, is for you to send this to me, I'll put it online and I'll advertise your show.
I can't help wondering what Freud might have made of comedian and writer David Baddiel's Twitter profile.
Yeah. OK, so you probably know, obviously, that you have a little bio and my biography is just the word Jew. And I did that mainly because I thought it was funny, but also as a kind of fuck-off to the anti-Semites, because there's a sort of sense in which just being OK and out of the closet about that, a lot of people think, oh, you know, they're sort of troubled by that in some weird way. I get lots of people slightly angry about that, about the lack of shame that they think I should have about that. So the word Jew in my bio is partly there to sort of, like, be saying, like, well, fuck off. You know, if you're going to get more anti-Semitic, I'm going to not get more Jewish because I'm as Jewish as I am. But, you know, I'm going to be prouder, I guess, of my Jewishness.
I don't do Twitter. I went on it a few times. And I do Instagram, but I don't have 500,000 followers. You've got 500,000 followers on Twitter. But when I went on Twitter, I always thought it was kind of people venting anger. Would you say that's true?
Well, yeah. A friend of mine said it's like a party, it's like, and all your friends are there and it's really nice. And it was for about 20 seconds. And then next thing I knew, people were very, very angry and shouting at me, shouting at lots of people.
And you still do it?
Yeah, because, yeah, I do. I mean, I don't... it doesn't bother me much, to be honest. And there's no question that my instinct is, you know, it's a sort of artistic project for a comedian, is how can I turn this into material?
And I can't help but pull similarities between applause, live applause and likes.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, there's no question. If a joke that I do gets a lot of likes and retweets, it feels virtually equivalent to getting a big laugh. And that obviously feels...
Is it the same buzz?
It feeds something.
Like,
it's not quite the
chemically,
same buzz.
You know.
It's not quite the same buzz because it's slower. Yeah. And, you know, anything on... What is different is that if you're in a club or a gig and you do a joke that gets a big laugh, it'll just be a big laugh normally. You might get a heckler, but normally it's just a big laugh. Whereas if you do a joke that gets a big laugh on Twitter, i.e. lots and lots of retweets, the more retweets you get, the more hate you'll get as well, because the joke spreads. Yeah.
It's mad.
So if you do a joke or even a comment that gets 12,000 retweets or whatever, you will definitely get loads and loads of hate for that.
12,000 people retweet things that you write on Twitter?
Yeah, sometimes.
That's insane.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. Yeah. This idea of, like, don't feed the trolls, don't get involved with the people who are being really abusive on social media, I disagree with that, partly because I am a comedian, it's part of my job to put down hecklers, but also people have tried ignoring the trolls, and now one of them is President of the United States. He is an internet troll, you know, and I don't think he would be president without this discourse having infiltrated life.
Pembrokeshire, Wales.
If I'm really, really honest, my sense of self is increasingly interwoven with technology, who I am, who I want to be, and how I let people know about it. So what would it be like to do without it? Emma turned her back on tech 20 years ago and headed for these woods in Wales, before the internet even really got going, and when the smartphone was little more than a twinkle in Apple's eye. It's quite early in the morning and we've just arrived at a small car park in the middle of nowhere at an undisclosed location. And it's not undisclosed because it's secret, it's just that we've taken so many turns and driven so far that I just don't know where I am anymore. And we've come to see someone called Emma. And we need to trek now through field and forest. And I've just had a phone call from one of the producers to tell me to leave my phone in the car, which got me thinking, this is probably the first time I've left my phone behind for about a year or two. Turning off. Emma lives off-grid and on her own, in a hut made of mud. Life here seems quite free and open, but there are a few rules, and one of them's about phones, and I left my phone in the car, which put me out of my comfort zone a little bit. thank you for that. Why is that, though?
Ah, yeah.
What do they represent, that why do we leave them behind?
Thank you. Loads of things in that question. You're right, there aren't many rules, but no stress is one of them. So that's the first place. They contribute to stress and lack of peace because people are constantly wondering if they've got a text or they should text somebody or make an arrangement, or I don't want it ringing in here, I don't want other people's problem fields or thoughts, you know. I would really like it if we evolve to a time when people don't let off their mobile phones in my aura, for example. So there's a sort of... it's like taking responsibility for what energy is going on, isn't it, in your environment.
Because your life is so unusual, do you wish that more people lived this life, or are you quite happy and, in a way, proud that you live differently?
I'm not happy and proud that I live differently from other people. I live like this because it makes me happy to live on the earth in a way that I feel is not destructive, yeah? And I do... In fact, last night I had a wave of sort of pain that not enough people care about the earth. That really distresses me periodically.
Yeah.
But I'm hopefully wise enough in my old age to know that you can't make people do things or change.
Yeah.
So I suppose my only hope is, why I'm speaking to you now, is that maybe if there's any way that I can help people understand that you can live simply and be happy, I can seed that possibility into anybody's mind, then that's nice for me.
I like that. I think we're in this age where everybody's very... we're in the era of the self, where everyone wants to be themselves, individual. Mm-hmm. This idea of Warhol's 15 minutes of fame has gone crazy, and it's now everyone wants a lifetime of attention, you know. And you, to me, you feel like you're more located in this idea that you're one of a collective.
That's, okay, thank you. My idea is to evolve my consciousness as far as I can, and that's a purely personal thing. And then also, to connect with a level of consciousness, maybe that's on a similar vibration or frequency. And I say to people who spend time here, your thoughts don't stop at the edge of your head. Remember that.
Where do they stop?
It depends on you, I think, the strength of your own mental field. But basically, they spread out, don't they? So I have a sort of sense that if I let in the fear consciousness into here, it can also see me and connect with me in this land. And I'm protecting this land from all of that. So I don't allow it here. In my part of the universe, the more love that is held as an energy, hopefully that's the better.
Emma makes her way into a field where a herd of goats are running about.
When I was talking to her, I was on my own after the film. We were just sitting there having a cup of tea with the wood smoke in her eyes and the flicker of the firelight. And I was explaining, she said, what art do you make? And I said, oh, I'll show you. And I put my hand in my pocket. I was like, oh, no, my phone. And it took me 3 seconds to think, remember that I'd actually left my phone in the car. It was like there's some kind of weird, it's like a phantom limb syndrome where it's become such an extension of me that it's like I'd missed part of me and forgotten where it was.
But what we're really losing is time, the only thing that we're all born with equal amounts of. Time to dream, time to think, time to just be in the present. It's the greatest asset that we have, and yet we throw so much of it away. Time is the new currency of our digital economy, and that economy demands our attention constantly.
A wall of video.
Dan TDM has 20 million subscribers on YouTube.
Some of you will know this already, but through social media and stuff, but unfortunately yesterday we had to say goodbye to Peggy. We had to she was never really a well dog anyway. So yesterday, she was just deteriorating really badly, and we made the decision to put her to sleep before...
His videos have been viewed more than 13 billion times, earning him a small fortune, 12 million quid last year alone.
And we didn't want that.
Sharing every aspect of his domestic life, he also plays and talks about Fortnite, one of the most popular video games on Earth.
So in the videos, would you say you're a performer?
Yeah.
But then there's also the persona of you that are loads of people who are your followers, your subscribers, they buy into you. But you just seem like a pretty normal guy. Do you know what I mean?
That's me, yeah. I'm
so
normal
it's like,
guy
I feel
playing
like there's
games.
A contradiction. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's more of a performance in the way of not being someone who's not me, like an actor would.
Right.
More of like an exaggerated version of myself. Whatever's in my brain, whatever I think when I'm playing a video game, I just say that out of my mouth. I think that's why YouTubers have such a strong and loyal following most of the time. It's because they are just being themselves. They're not a caricature or not someone who's being ingenuine or trying to be someone else.
Oh, people can relate to that as
fully
well.
Fully relatable, yeah. That's why...
Because they're proper humans.
Exactly. And they usually share a lot of their personal lives. Like, people know the names of my dogs, my wife, loads of aspects of your life that you share online. And religiously, I would post
back when I was like really growing the channel and properly grinding out, I would post two videos every day, which would take me hours and hours and hours, sometimes like 10, 12 hours a day, and then rinse and repeat, because you'd finish those two videos, go to sleep, wake up and do it again.
I mean, does that stress you out that there's 20 million people waiting?
It does a lot, yeah. I think you can easily get stuck in that cycle of, I have to upload every day. And it's really hard to break it because of those elements.
Do you ever unwire, unplug? Do you ever, like, just go cold turkey, turn your phone off and go away to the Alps for a week?
I don't know. I'm really bad at that. It's like a...
When did you last do that?
When did I last have an actual holiday?
Yeah, where you're not uploading anything or posting on your feeds or...
I can't remember.
Really?
Honestly, yeah. I can't remember. Not a holiday for myself that wasn't attached to any work whatsoever. I can't remember the last time.
What I would like you to do, really, is just stop. I just think that the landscape is completely beautiful and serene. You see it?
Yeah.
I know you're probably going to get killed if you stop, but...
It's like a...
just thought you could take a minute now inside the game and...
Mm-hmm.
Like the holiday that you have not had, you could do it there in this beautiful landscape.
You could, yeah.
Digitally.
And there's times in video games where it is just... The whole landscape is so beautiful that you do get lost in it. That's why people play video games. It's an escape from... whatever you're doing.
I'm going to do a meditation up here. Look, I'm going to go, I'm going to unwind. Can you drop the gum?
Can you
have your hands free or not?
If you press, I think it's down. No, you're just free to...
Free of all my earthly groundings. No more baggage.
No people to disturb you.
Just take a minute to take a breath in through the nose. And through the mouth. It's beautiful though, isn't it, up here?
Yeah, I love the way this game looks.
You see, I like it at this speed. It's just the whole... taking the atmosphere. It's nice, though.
Yeah.
Have you ever done that?
No.
So has technology allowed you to become yourself?
Yeah, I guess so, because without technology, I wouldn't be in the job that I'm in, and I would be a different person.
So how much of yourself do you give away to make yourself relatable to your audience? This is a bad time to ask you a question.
This is a bad time.
I'm so sorry. Whoever that is, they've really got it in for you.
Oh, I messed that up so badly. Sorry, what was the question?
A stuffed sheep in a glass display case that's slowly revolving. Ryan watches the sheep rotate.
Technology has always changed our sense of self. Take Dolly the sheep, the first cloned mammal, and the first copy of herself. But we haven't tried it yet with humans. For now, perhaps this app is as close as we can get.
Ellie G.
I am Ellie G.
But my wife doesn't sound convinced.
Yeah, that's better.
Which is better, this one?
Well, that's the only one who I'd want to go out with. Oh, no, that one's all right.
Becca, we're married. We're not going out anymore.
It's reproduction that creates new versions of us, made partly in our own image. And babies need parents. Which for most of us means a relationship, and there's an app for that too. In fact, there are dozens and dozens of them for those in search of their other half. In the heart of Silicon Valley, in San Jose, California, lives Christy. She's single, but she doesn't want to be.
Who is your Mr. Right?
I'm someone hardworking, good values, loves kids. And I definitely want a family.
And Christy's got a plan, a secret plan, that could never have existed a generation ago.
Which platforms have you used to to meet people?
I pretty much tried all of them, and I recently found a service called Vita. It's kind of like a guilty secret.
So if it's a secret, who's it a secret from?
It's probably like my potential mate that I end up finding on this, but...
So who knows? Do your friends know that you've done this?
Yes, my girlfriends definitely, and some guy friends know too. They think it's pretty fun.
Christy's secret is that she uses an online service to impersonate her on all the dating websites that she's signed up for. And as part of the package, they write her new profile, not her.
Do you have your profile here on your phone?
Let me see if I can pull it up.
I'm going to read your profile and then see from talking to you if you match your matchmaker's reality of you.
Okay. Read through it.
My God, it's so poetic. Is this what they wrote?
Yes.
It says, a vivid red sundress, perfectly chilled champagne flute, golf clubs in tow. That's my idea of a perfect afternoon. What's yours? That's a professional writer's written that. It's full of imagery, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'll read a bit more. I'm very active, upbeat and energetic with maybe 1, 2 or 10, but definitely not 11 interests. Funny bit. Plus, I love a good laugh. I would say more, but the rest of the details are highly classified. Special clearance required. Weird winking emoji. Bit naughty.
What's weird about it?
I don't know. It's a bit more clearance required. But, you see, would you be that sassy?
Yes.
If you were, you would.
Very.
So it is a true reflection.
I think so. Yeah, I had to approve this. Like, I would not have approved it if it, I didn't feel like, was how I would write it. I mean, I'm presenting, like, a product that's myself, a true reflection of myself, so I guess I don't feel so bad about that.
Next come the flirty texts, written by a stranger to another stranger.
Are you not worried that the people that are effectively ghostwriting you are producing an idealised reality of you, of yourself?
I don't know. I don't think it's really creating an idealised version. And they only have permission to answer based on, like, what I've told them information-wise. So, and if there's something they don't know how to answer, they refer back to me, like, in an email form. So I'm definitely in control of the process. I'm on there looking at what's going on, like, what's being said. I mean, I guess if I just quit my job and was just online dating 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, I'm sure I'd get pretty good results. But it's kind of a time issue. But I'm just a modern girl trying to... do the most efficient, if this is the most efficient process to do online dating. And it's not my preferred way to meet people, but.
Bring back meeting people in nightclubs, that's what I say.
Or bars and restaurants, yeah. I totally agree with you. I
be your mirror. Call me old fashioned, but this feels like a massive delegation of self. And Christy seems to have come to terms with it. But what about the person paid to impersonate her? Ben works for the service that Christy uses.
I'm not going to lie about them, basically. I'm going to pretend to be them, but I'm not going to pretend that they're something they're not.
And the people that are recipients of that information that you give out, they have no idea that it's not this real person, that it's a ghostwriter.
Yeah, they don't know it's a ghostwriter, no. We have certain, what we'd call icebreakers, opening messages. After that, you kind of go off-piste, but...
Can you give me one?
You'd just say, hey, you know, whatever their name was, pop personality quiz, pineapple on pizza, yes or no. That got a massive... That would get a response the majority of the time. And the kind of rationale behind that is the fact that there's not too much thinking involved. A lot, like...
I don't know the answer to it, but I'm just...
It doesn't matter what the answer
is. I wasn't listening. I'm just so astounded that it sounds completely natural.
Of course. Otherwise, it wouldn't work.
That's why you get paid to do it.
But also, it's because there are certain principles behind the messages. You don't want to give an open-ended question. So if you get a message from someone you've never met, you've never spoken to before, and it requires you to think for, like, 10 minutes... If you get a question saying, tell me something unique about yourself, that's something that people... quite often send some question of that nature and they think that sounds quite good, but actually it's terrible.
Why?
Because it's open-ended and basically no one's going to bother doing that for a stranger. If you say,
pineapple on pizza, yes or no? A, it's kind of a little bit quirky, a bit silly. B, it's something that, weirdly, people do tend to have quite strong opinions on. And C, they can just say yes or no.
And it's amazing.
Sometimes that happens. Sometimes someone will type in yes. And you can work with that. You can build on it.
When you're writing for the digital self or the digital version of the self and the actual self is there, that surely they don't correlate.
That's 100% true, but I think in the modern world where everybody has experience of having a digital self and a real self, people are aware of the fact that a digital self is somewhat curated anyway. So people know from their own experience that they're slightly different online than they are in real life. It doesn't come across as an immediate discrepancy if someone talks slightly differently in a real life meeting than they do online, because I think probably everyone does that anyway.
That we all just accept that the digital self is fake.
I wouldn't say it's fake, it's more like a copy of, not even a copy of yourself, it's like a copy of a copy.
What happens when these people meet the people? There's an actual physical encounter. Do they then have to pretend to be the pretense that you were pretending to be them?
Well,
or do they act naturally and is it, you know, uncovered in the meeting that the...
Well, philosophically, what is worse or what's more dishonest? Me trying to give an honest portrayal of Mr. X's personality and character, or someone else being untruthful about themselves, because there's plenty of people online who are being themselves, but they're not being truthful about themselves.
That's the clearest and most sensible thing I've heard this week, probably.
A coin telescope.
Digital technology now offers us all the tools of true reinvention and the fakest of news. And those tools are made here, San Francisco, and beyond it, Silicon Valley. Once a city built on openness, now the place our future is being written in top secret, behind the heavily guarded temple doors of the tech giants. Only their logos, the new icons of our time, are accessible to all. First stop, Google.
Not filming. Can I take video on my phone? I'm allowed to take a video on my phone. I'm on a pilgrimage.
Oh, I mean, of course, yeah.
Next stop, Instagram.
Hiya. Can I take a selfie with that logo?
Yes, you can. Are you guys employees here?
No. I'm just a tourist.
Okay.
Ryan takes a series of selfies.
And finally, Apple, creators of a phone that literally changed the world, and a new headquarters that's so vast it's hard to take it all in. Forget Willy Wonka, this is the real chocolate factory, and you can just make out some Oompa Loompas in chinos in the distance. We have no idea what the biggest brains of California are working on next. And that's the way they like it, because the next product due for an upgrade is probably us. Technology already feels like an extension of who we are, so why not go the whole hog?
So I have a chip implant right
here.
Can
I touch it?
Yeah. It's just tiny. I mean, it's literally the size of a grain of rice. You inject
it. And that's a scar.
In with a needle. Yeah, I mean, it's so small. It's just, you know, literally through an injection. And anyways, I use it to open my front door, start cars, stuff like that, but it's a...
Meet Zoltan Istvan, journalist, presidential candidate, and transhuman. And if you're wondering what that is, it's a human, but better. Keen to put technology inside their body in the name of self-improvement.
Access to that technology. Transhumanism is born out of the need to try to improve one's position. Oneself. The future of a transhumanist is not flesh. It's something of data components, something of ones and zeros. And most transhumanists have some disability of some sort. That's why they were attracted to transhumanism in the first place. Whether it's being in a wheelchair and wanting to get out of it through exoskeleton technology or stem cell technology or whatever it is, this is what transhumanism is about.
There's an incredible difference between using technology to enhance someone beyond the human capability and to enhance someone who's in an unfortunate position to become equal with the rest of humans. They're two totally different things.
For me, it's always about improvement and functionality. If technology makes us more functional, why not just, you know, let's say get out of the wheelchair, why not put on legs that allow you to become the fastest runner in the world, run faster than cheetahs? That's almost guaranteed, either through exoskeleton technology or genetic editing, and this is amazing. Can you imagine that the Paralympics, in that time, those people will be stronger?
It's not that amazing, really. I don't want to run faster than cheetah. I rarely meet cheetahs. and there's a lot of things that I feel like you're trying to sell at me. But there's a lot of these things where I think if you retain the very essence of being human and not messing with yourself, there is also a quality in that. I really am completely happy being Ryan. There's just nothing that I want to do that I can't do.
Zoltan gazes at him.
We used to talk, as humans, we used to talk a lot about the soul. No, we don't talk about the soul, it seems, anymore. We talk about the self, the present time, orientation of who we are in the now, in the moment. What is the next soul or the next self?
Well, the next self is potentially the singularity. The singularity is a moment in time when the microprocessor starts getting so quick in evolving. The key is to put our brain and our thoughts into machines and evolve with that technology, because if we don't, AI will leave us behind very quickly. So our entire sense of self is going to grow. We are like babies right now in the real universe of intelligence. We're about to merge with an intelligence that is far greater than the brain, the 3 pounds of meat can muster. And that's the new sense of self. I would say, as a transhumanist, retaining my individuality is not the most essential thing, as long as I'm happy with my progress and my development as a living entity.
So who will you be in 20 years?
Well, in 20 years, I'll probably still be Zoltan, but I'm almost certain to have mostly machine parts. I'm definitely on a list to, a volunteer list to have one of these implants that connect to AI. And I'm sure I'll have limbs that are robotics. For someone like me, a lot of the technology that I want from transhumanism is not actually here. I don't have the robotic arm yet because it's not in my best interest to cut off my biological one. Well, this one's still more functional. I think that's going to change in 7 to 10 years. So if we redid this interview in 10 years, I'm pretty sure I'd have the robotic one by then. We're not a very good species. We're getting better, though. And that's really where the technology comes, where we can keep the best parts of our species and make ourselves much, much better. And I think at some point, we make ourselves nearly perfect.
Would you say that you or the transhumanist manifesto or mission statement is embroiled with the need for control?
Transhumanism is all about control. It's all about the idea that we can control the body and what the world is trying to do to us. And that's really what transhumanists want. They want power over all of nature.
Outside Zoltan's house,
I think he's really excited by the self that he could be. But that's the thing with the imagination. We can imagine a whole load of different idealized selves, can't we? And this is another extension of that.
This is the idea that created the modern United States, and it runs through its tech industry like letters through Blackpool Rock. Extreme optimism and radical self-improvement with the aid of the latest technology. And it drove the pioneers further and further west towards California in search of opportunity and a new relationship with nature itself.
A plane coming into land.
Down by the airport in Scottsdale, Arizona, are the usual selection of long-term storage facilities. But one of them is no ordinary lockup. The Alcor Life Extension Foundation uses the best technology available to wait for a scientific breakthrough that hasn't even happened yet, raising the dead.
Hi.
Hello.
Is it Max?
Max Moore, yes. Ryan. Welcome to the Alcor Life Extension Foundation.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Well, it gets come from the boiling heat out there into the nice cool...
It's boiling, isn't it?
...inside, and it's even cooler than liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Can I maybe start with a couple of the photos over here that might be sort of humanise this a little bit?
Alcor's business, in a nutshell, is freezing dead bodies for $200,000 a time. And 130 of their clients hail from Silicon Valley.
This is Hal Finney, an old friend of mine, who's actually one of the creators of Bitcoin. He's the first recipient of Bitcoin. He moved out here from California and checked into a hospice. And he basically said, once I can no longer communicate at all, then I want my respirator turned off and I want you guys to go ahead. This is by far our youngest patient. This poor little girl had pediatric brain cancer, didn't quite reach her third birthday, had multiple brain surgeries. This is in Thailand. And eventually her parents, who were both doctors, arranged ahead of time. We sent a neurosurgeon over there on the team and we were able to successfully cryopreserve her.
Do you know what? When I think about the science of it, it's kind of clinical and all right to manage, but when you see the photos, it becomes incredibly emotional and human. And
especially when you know someone personally, as I do in some of these cases. Yeah. That was very difficult, knowing how. If the structure of the brain is intact, and if we think that one day we'll be able to repair that and restart that metabolism, they're not really gone. All the stuff that makes me who I am is up here, my memories, my personalities, my values, my experience. So that's the bit I really want to keep.
Imagine waking up in the future, disorientated.
People choose to do this, they're expecting this. So if you took someone who wasn't expecting it and they suddenly woke up in the future, it would be a huge shock. But these are people who maybe signed up for, like me, for decades, have been thinking about this. And so I think my first reaction will be, it's what? 2092? Yes! I made it!
Really?
I think that'll be my reaction. It won't be like, oh my God, what am I going to do? No, I don't think so.
They make their way through the lobby. Then, as they turn into a corridor, Ryan stops.
I've got a hospital phobia, and this looks really like a hospital.
Well, there's going to be an operating room that we go into next, so... Okay. Unless you want to skip that.
Just need to hold my breath.
A bright clinical room.
Well, it's essentially just like a hospital, isn't it?
Kind of, yeah.
Surgical implements.
This is where we do the surgery, in fact, which is really the second part of our process.
What's that?
That is just a dummy head. They're doing some experiments with.
If you are on a budget, Max's team will remove your head and freeze just that for a reduced price of $80,000. And they do that in here.
Usually you'll start here, and then the surgeon will do a separation of a few vertebrae down, and then we'll take the cephalon, as we call it, which is basically the brain plus the skull.
You take the face as well?
Yeah, everything from here upwards, basically.
So it's not just the brain, it's the entire head?
Yes.
And reason, part of the spinal column?
A little bit, yeah, part of the spinal column. And the reason for that is it's just really hard to remove the brain from the skull without damaging it. So it's just a useful protective mechanism.
But
it's the brain we're interested in, really.
Right.
The face obviously is going to have to be regenerated. And then we will move it to the neuro box over here.
This is intense.
So if you're a neuro patient, we'll take the cephalon, it'll be put upside down in the ring there. And then instead of going in through the heart, we use the carotids and basically do the same procedure, recirculating until the blood has been replaced by the cryoprotectant solution.
Can I say, I think some people would say that you were completely mad.
Well, some people do say that.
Do they?
Yeah. They're wrong, but they do say that and they're entitled to their opinion.
It's just so out of the norm. It's so out of people's understanding of...
The same was said of open-heart surgery, the same was said of in vitro fertilization, the zombies that will come from test tube babies. Louise Brown, the first one, right in England, turned out fine. There are like millions of people walking around who must be zombies because they were frozen as embryos. So there's always that factor when people are unfamiliar with something. But once they get used to it, it becomes normal.
But this isn't about science. I reckon it's about ego and our inability to let go of the idea of us, the concept that the world won't care when we're gone. Those thoughts, that need for immortality, lead some people here.
Welcome to Aqua's patient care bay.
Ryan looks troubled. A dimly lit chamber.
Looks like Star Trek.
Well, this is interesting lighting because people expect it to look like Star Trek, and with the full lights on, it doesn't look quite as interesting. So we try to spice it up a little bit.
It's funny how blue LEDs are always some kind of ridiculous stereotype of the future.
I guess so, yeah. Actually, we can change the colour of these two.
Can you put the normal lights on?
Yes. We can see a little bit better then.
164 corpses waiting for the ultimate upgrade, from death to life.
There's just one patient in each tube.
No, there's four.
There's four?
Yeah.
You have four standing up bodies mm-hmm. in these things that make them smaller, and then you have heads up the middle. Mm-hmm. And you can't... Can you choose who you were in the flask with?
Not really, because... Well, in principle, you could if you're willing to pay to keep the slots empty, because we've got to pay. You know, it costs us
I like
to keep
me
open.
Privacy.
So, well, if you want to pay the extra, we actually have had that request from some, both of your families, like, can we reserve this for our family? Well, yeah, as long as you pay for it.
To be honest, I find all this a bit chilling. The fantasy of a tiny Lazarus kept alive by technology and the reality of a former self preserved in the zeros and ones of a digital photograph. But maybe that's how we'll all really be remembered. And who knows, maybe even reborn. The self-portraits of our digital lives may seem frivolous now, but they'll outlive us all. The tech giants will make sure of it. If you don't tell them to end your online existence, then they won't. So maybe we can live forever, after all. This is Facebook's headquarters, the last stop on my digital pilgrimage, and social media's ground zero. A vast, multicoloured castle built on a mountain of self.
A giant thumbs up.
But in our rush to find ourselves within these virtual walls, let's not lose sight of who we really are. I reckon we need to see the wood as well as the trees.
As I was coming through the trees to where the billboard is with the happy like thumb, there was some amazing graffiti which I actually took a photo of. Someone had scratched into one of the trees next to the Facebook billboard. Just two letters. Me. Me.
Just two letters that sum up everything that can be found through new technology and digital media, but also what can so easily be lost.
The song on the meadow is somber reward. The stag in the